You guys can be seated. I really thought that I had given you parts 3 through 5 that I have in my outline, and because I wanted you to have the exercise on it. How many of you did get a chance to kind of go back over those first, I suppose, 3 or 4 points? Why was Deborah needed? Where was the vacuum? I think we actually touched on quite a bit of that, didn't we? And so what I'm going to do is I do want to read from verses 8 through the end of chapter 4. And then I'll just actually raise the questions that I have in my outline, and we'll talk about it preliminary to the war that I think is going to be critical to the interpretation. So I'll do that, and then we'll see what we can get out of tonight. Let me see here. So Erica, I got your note, okay? Judges chapter 4, verse 8. And Barak said unto her, that is Deborah, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, then I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with thee, notwithstanding the journey that you take shall not be for your honor. For the Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and he went up with 10,000 men at his feet, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent unto the plain of Zanaim, which is by Kadesh. And they showed Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam was gone up to the Mount Tabor, and Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron, and all the people that were with him from Harosheth of the Gentiles unto the river of Kishon. And Deborah said unto Barak, up, for this is the day in the which the Lord hath delivered Sisera into the hand, or into your hand. Is not the Lord gone out before thee? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor and 10,000 men after him. And the Lord discomfited Sisera and all his chariots and all of his host with the edge of the sword before Barak, so that Sisera lighted down off of his chariot and fled away on his feet. But Barak pursued after the chariot and after the host unto Harosheth of the Gentiles, and all the host of Sisera fell upon the edge of the sword, and there was none a man left. Howbeit, Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said unto him, turn in, my lord, turn in to me, fear not. And when he had turned in unto her into the tent, she covered him with a mantle. And he said unto her, give me, I pray thee, a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. And she opened a bottle of milk and gave him drink and covered him. And again said unto her, he said unto her, stand in the door of the tent, and it shall be, when any man doth come and inquire of thee, and say, is there any man here, that thou shalt say, no. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent, and took a hammer in her hand, and went softly unto him, and smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it into the ground. For he was fast asleep and tired, so he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said unto him, come, and I will show thee the man whom you seek. And when he came in to her tent, behold, Sisera lay dead, and the nail was in his temples. So God subdued on that day Jabin the king of Canaan before the children of Israel, and the hand of the children of Israel prospered and prevailed against Jabin the king of Canaan until they had destroyed Jabin king of Canaan. Thus is the reading of the scriptures. Remember the context in which this account is given, because I think that framework is critical as we begin to explore a little bit more fully this unique position that our sister Deborah is exercising. If you guys remember our discussion in the previous classes, one of the things I emphasized was that we are in a context of war. Okay, that's critical here. There are many other components to the lesson that we have to learn, but we are in a context of war. And what that means is that the children of Israel have to be settled with the fact that they have enemies. You guys got that? So, the fact that they have enemies. And we had already learned in chapter three, that God told them that they would have to go to war, that they would have to fight battles, that they would have to engage their enemies. And I say that to say that sometimes I don't believe that we really understand that Christianity is a warfare. Now, I know that you know that right now while you're sitting here. But sometimes we can fail to understand that this warfare is tricky. It's difficult. It's not fair. It's subtle in many ways. And it will take advantage of you if you are not committed to reality. So I want to set the context to see if we can make this work a little bit. I hope you all have your outlines. If we know that we are in a perpetual warfare, then we are going to be mindful of that, are we not? And we're not going to be daydreaming. We're not going to be living in a surreal world that everything is peaceful and that everyone's my friend. And that even those whom I assume are my friend presently may in fact not be my friend. Now, again, I'm setting the context because this is critical to the narrative of the book of Judges. Because I heard some of you squinch a little bit when my sister JL went to work. I heard you squinch. And that squinching would indicate the fact that you weren't thinking in terms of a warfare. That you weren't thinking in terms of an enemy that is a mortal threat to your soul. That in a wartime scenario, even women will be called upon to do things that are not normally women-like characteristics. But it's critical to understand that that is what they were called into. The wilderness was dependence. The land of Canaan is deployment. And that we are all in a war. And that in the war, we all have assignments. Now, when we opened up, before we opened up dealing with God's dealings with Israel and the severity of the oppression, Sisera from Canaan had really oppressed Israel for a long period of time. It was a long time that they were under his oppression. They were suffering at his hands. And it was so bad, as we learned 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I don't remember when it was, that the state and condition of Israel at this time was that the men were rare. You guys actually, have you ascertained that in the text? That the normative health of a body politic when it comes to men, women, and families in a culture, in a nation, the normative health is that of strong male presence, if for no other reason, provision and protection. Provision and protection. I hope you accept that premise. That the purpose for which males would be around in the context of human existence is to protect the women and the children and to provide largely, not exclusively, but largely the material and physical needs of the family, correct? So I'm revisiting a framework and structure that's critical to our now backing out and doing more of a personal analysis of the role of Deborah, the role of Barak, And in a moment, here to come, the role of a very unusual woman who will be involved in this battle, who rises up into the midst of our narrative in almost a very surprising and unforeseen way. And how all that actually is much more common than we want to admit, given the fact that we are in a warfare. Given the fact that we've been oppressed by the enemy so long. And now the rumors have gone about that Sister Deborah has entered into a collaboration with Barak to actually go to war against our adversaries. You guys got the context? So our families in Israel, as we learned 2 weeks ago through the Song of Deborah in chapter 5, were devastated by the oppression. The text tells us that Sisera exceedingly oppressed Israel. They were grievously oppressed, and that now there is something about to take place to solve this problem, right? So the mindset, I think, of the people of God, as we're going to see when we get to chapter 5, is one or two things. About time. I'm tired of being oppressed. I'm tired of being the tail and not the head. I'm tired of being in a takeaway mode. I'm tired of the adversary having its way in my life. I'm tired of being plundered. I think that's the mentality. I think there's a point. This is psychological, certainly, but I think it's a point in our life when we are in the throes of chastisement. We can call it chastisement, correct? Because we have disobeyed God, and our inclination to idolatry has opened the door up for him to take away our strength and take away our vitality and allow the very adversaries that we're supposed to be subduing to have their way with us for a season. And they do, and then we get tired of it, don't we? As a child of God, we get tired of it. We may not know how to fix it, but we get tired of it. And that's at that point now, God is ready to turn things around when we get tired of it. 8 years is a long time to be oppressed. 20 years is a long time to be oppressed. And to look up and to have very few valiant men available. And then a man rises on the scene whose name is Barak. Do you guys remember what we observed about Sister Deborah when we opened up our discussion? What did her name mean? What did we explore in terms of the meaning of her name? You guys remember that? Who is Deborah? What does she signify? What did her name signify? What's that? Mm-hmm. Deborah, the root word Deborah is Debar, which means the word of God, God's counsel, his instruction. What else did we know? The Bible frequently talks about the children being born, being named by their parents in relationship to or reflecting a characteristic or attribute of God, right? There was another interpretation that's given to it, or definition given to it. Do you guys remember what that was? You're talking too low for me to hear you. Mm-hmm. Execute instruction, because that's the way the word spreads itself out throughout the lexicon. So Deborah is representing God's counsel. She's representing God's instructions. She's representing God's wisdom. She's representing God's precepts. She's representing God's law and his statutes. This is remarkable, but it's not uncommon with God. The name Deborah is a feminine name, obviously, that is tied to God's word. And what is Deborah in terms of her role over Israel? She's a judge, right? And as a judge, would she not then adjudicate the law? Would she not then interpret the law? Would the interpretation that she render serve to give insight and wisdom and counsel and instruction to the people of God? Would that be the case? Of course. So then what would that make Deborah in terms of a functional ruler over the people of God? What would be the word? She would be what? If she's instructing you out of the law, if she's educating you out of the law, if she's helping you rightly divide the word, if she's deliberating controversies, as Deuteronomy 16 and 17 said, if there's a controversy that rises up between men and they don't know how to work it out, let them go to the judges, right? What would we call her on a practical level who is gifted to make those kinds of legislative decisions? A mediator, that's a practical role. I can accept that. Something else more vocational. An arbitrator, I guess so. That's dealing with the controversial element, but we've just got through talking about her simply giving interpretation to and explaining, and she wouldn't be a pastor, she would be a teacher. Well, maybe a pastor in the sense that the role in a agricultural or a metaphorical sense is to feed the sheep, right? But she's a teacher. She's teaching. That's the role of the judge, to teach. In part, her role was to teach. And I'm highlighting that because we're getting ready to kind of go deeper into her calling. This is what the text tells us, that Deborah, she dwelt by the palm trees, and her husband was Lapidoth, verse 5, and she dwelt under the palm trees of Deborah. In fact, they actually called a region of the palm tree area, which was by Jericho, the palm tree of Deborah, between Ramah and Bethel and the Mount Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now, that phrase, that idea of her dwelling under the palm trees is where she actually educated the people. It's kind of like where she had her citadel. And in fact, according to culture and history, that this was not uncommon in those nomadic days where the elders would sit. They would sit under trees and people would come to them. Because you guys got to remember, we're still dealing with a very archaic culture, an old culture. They're not driving cars. They're not living in brick homes. This is very archaic. And so being out in the open under the trees, they would come to this lady to receive instruction. This is the context in which the people of God are coming to her for wisdom. And her ability to educate and to communicate to the people of God how they should be acting actually falls under another role. And the text says that it's prophetic, right? That she was a prophetess, right? So she's an educator. But she's also a prophetess, an educator, someone who knows God's law, knows his word, knows his precepts, and is therefore capable of rightly dividing the word of God and helping people stay on the right path or correct their ways so that they can live prosperously before God. But also, she has a vital relationship with God on a level where God speaks through her on a prophetic level by which she instructs the people of God for their present welfare in their relationship and walk with God. She's a prophetess. She's a legitimate prophetess. For me, this all has to do with her unique, blessed calling to help the people of God in a very paradoxical context. And that paradoxical context, as we stated last week or 2 weeks ago, is that we don't have a lot of men. We don't have prosperity in the land. Our economy is threatened. Our welfare is threatened. I could probably say that we're also struggling with healthy homes. How many of you guys been listening to our Monday program recently? Did you guys catch any of that? And you heard me broaching the subject of struggling African-American culture, particularly in the context of the church. And if you would extrapolate that, and you could because you are a product of it, as I am, you understand economic issues, educational issues, domestic issues become extremely devastating in the life of a people group when those resources are diminished or taken away. They all are part of a strategy of destruction on the part of a people group, right? We didn't go too deep into some of the underlying causes because time didn't allow, but you can actually sympathize with the context in which Deborah is doing ministry, Deborah. She's not doing ministry in prosperous times. She's doing ministry where the people of God as a whole are in slavery. And I really can make an immediate application to where you and I are in our culture today. Obviously, we are not as devastated or depleted as Israel was at that time, but we're on a trajectory for it. Be sure of that, that when God disciplines a nation, he definitely disciplines them in the area of finances. And those become sort of dire times where if there is a perpetual hardening of the heart, because we just love our idolatries, we don't turn, we don't call on God, we don't repent. We just watch the finances dissipate, right? And as the finances dissipate, we see bad behavior on the part of the powerful towards the vulnerable. We see the powerful preserving their wealth while the vulnerable are suffering the ravages and immediate impact of the famine or inflation or loss of jobs. You guys understand what I'm saying? And then it has this trickle-down effect, because if the family is uncertain of the meal that they're going to eat today, then everybody in the household is disturbed emotionally and psychologically, are they not? This would include the children. And if over a long enough period of time, you guys help me by way of application, because I'm just laying down some foundations, because when we get into this war scenario is going to really help us understand how much God is in both the discipline and the recovery. Like where we are in our nation now, and I've been talking about this for a good over 10 years, since 9/11. I've been talking to us at Grace about the gradual trickle down and diminishing of our economic powers. I've been telling us since 2001 that we would see a takeaway process, and have we not been seeing it? That our leaders who have been elected into office would be less qualified election after election after election, less qualified to lead us up out of our trouble, marginally gifted, and having really no prophetic insight. And I'm actually quoting Isaiah chapter 3, where God says, I will take away the stay and the staff, the whole stay and the whole staff of bread I'll take away from you. And the stay and the staff refers to the provisions of economic wealth by which we obtain the bread, which is a metaphor for provisions of our life. God says, I'll take that away from you. And that starts at the top with our legislators, with our government, with our judiciary, with our educators, with our religious institutions. And we see the same thing happening in the book of Judges here as we are actually experiencing in our culture. And it reaches a time when the people become so desperate that it doesn't matter who it is that has the wisdom, somebody rise up and start giving an answer to the problems that are at hand. That's the context in which we are dealing with that. And you and I have admitted and acknowledged the merciful hand of a sovereign God to raise up Deborah in that context. And that's the reason why I opened up again saying, remember now, don't just see her as a female. She is a female for a very critical purpose, which I have in my outline for points 3, 4, and 5. But see her as a tool in the hand of God, a tool in the hand of God specifically designed to meet the criteriums for the present distress that's taking place. The present distress that's taking place is the devastation of the people group all the way down to the families. So much so that as we read in chapter 5 in the Song of Deborah, that she looked for the warriors. She looked for the mighty men. She asked the question, where are they at? Verse 8, they chose new gods, chapter 5. Then there was war in the gates. Was there a shield or spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? And that was a rhetorical statement, and we know the answer is no. So you see, verse 8, the opening line, they chose new gods. We call that the cause or crux of the problem, which is idolatry, right? Then there was war in the gate, right? And that's the necessary outcome of rebelling against a covenant God. God says, if you rebel against me, I will back away and allow the enemy to come in. Right. And at that point, we would expect, when once the enemy comes in, we would expect that the men of the place would rise up and go to war against the adversaries. Right. But no shields, no spears, which means our major problem is the evacuation of strong male leadership, which brings us back to verse 7. the inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel. Do you see the diminishing of the people groups? The inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel. I'm going to deal with the next line in a moment, but I just want to stay there and see if we can develop the picture. See, in the takeaway process, everything diminishes. How many of you know prosperous times in your life? And then after a period of time, you entered into a deficit. And things diminished, right? And in that process, what you saw was correlating factors that you didn't anticipate. Like, you could have anticipated the loss of income by virtue of, you know, just difficult times. Or a misstep on your part. How many of you have ever lost a job because of something stupid you've done? Okay, you ain't got to raise your hand. I have. Doing something stupid is often the way God is going to get your attention. Let's say you are prospering economically. You're in a good job, and you've had that job for a long time. But you're not doing right by God. Yeah, now y'all know what I'm talking about, right? And God has been trying to get your attention because you're living large and you're enjoying life, but you're not really giving God his propers. And then you get a little bit careless and you make a critical mistake on the job and you are either demoted or you lose that job. Have you been there? Good. A few of you have. The rest of you too young to actually even know what we're talking about. Now God has gotten your attention a little bit because what you recognize at this moment is that you are out of control. See, here's where we get in trouble. We get in trouble when we assume that everything is under control, right? This is where our propensity to commit idolatry against our God rises up, because all of the structures are in place. And we can manage our life in a way that we can actually provide for the lust of the flesh. It's kind of a presumption. Now, if you don't know, ladies, if you haven't been here, just get the CD and put it in your pocket. Because when it comes, you'll be able to pull it back and say, you know what? They were right. You're kind of operating out of a presumption. This is the earlier chapter of the book of Judges when Israel waxed strong. Remember that? When they were strong. And that's the notion of you and I are going about our perfunctory ways and everything is all right. And we are operating out of an assumption that it's going to always remain all right. And then, boom, you do something wrong. I mean, you said, man, I'm too intelligent for this. I'm too wise for this. But here I made a critical mistake and I'm either demoted on my job or I lose my job. Right? So here we are in a moment where we have a loss of control. Because you didn't intend to lose that job, but you lost it. Here's another loss of control that is associated with it. You go out with your resume. You may even enhance your resume and bump your resume up and clean your resume up. And you send out 500 resumes. And you sit back very comfortable because you are gifted, skilled. You are the best thing in the world. Everybody needs you. And nothing happens. For weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Now, you know what you're doing right about now? You're complaining to God. Right? You're complaining because you presumed that your skill levels were going to open the door, when the one that actually opens the door is God. But see, you are actually in a bad way with God, and you thought you could get around God by your resume. Right? But see, when God shuts doors, he shuts doors, right? And you got all kind of things going on in your jacked up head with all of the bad cobwebs and stuff about how the people throwing your resume in the garbage can, or it's sitting there still in the desk, or somehow it didn't make it to the right people. You know how we do all that? Completely disregarding first causes, right? See, now we're supposed to be the people of God, and we're supposed to know that God's sovereign. He controls all things. He turns the hearts of the, you know, kings whithersoever he wills. God opens doors, shut doors. God causes a person to see you. We're supposed to be the people of favor, right? But when God cuts that favor off and we're out of control, you and I now are struggling with the character and nature of God. But it was our idolatry that set us up for misrepresenting God in our own mind, right? Or our idolatry caused us to fail to remember that a covenant God must discipline us when we get off course, because more important to God than your bank account is your character. Right? So now I'm making some application. Because that's what's going on a larger aggregate whole. And I'm going to cut this heat down so that my sister won't die on me. But on a larger aggregate whole, the whole of Israel is struggling through that. So stay with me a little bit on this, because it gets worse when our finances are threatened and the jobs aren't coming in. What does that have a tendency to make us do? When the money is not coming in and money is funny, and we are used to certain standards of living, but we're not right spiritually. What does that have an inclination to cause us to do? Now, at this moment, as you begin to respond, I want you to tell it true. Don't lie to me. Okay, because we can do the religious thing. You know what? Well, I start praying. No, you were praying way back then, and that didn't work. So you moved on to plan B. And when God wasn't hearing your prayers, because God doesn't have to hear your prayers. I mean, he hears everything, omniscience. But when we talk about hearing, it means he inclines his ear to you personally and intentionally to regard your prayer. But we are told in Psalm 68, I believe, if I regard iniquity in my heart, what? He won't hear us. Is that true? And then we are surprised because we told him we were sorry. And we still didn't get the job the next day. Right? Do you guys remember that? Lord, I'm sorry. But the Lord knows you weren't really sorry. So I'm laying the context here, because the battle in which these three heroines are engaged in have so much theology for us that I don't want to lose it by not giving you a proper context. Okay? So what happens when a husband and wife are working to pay the bills? They've had a good season, a good run of economic consistency and prosperity, but they have squandered quite a bit of it because they just forgot the Lord. I just put it like that. They just forgot the Lord. They bought a nice car, and the payment is about $700 a month. Now, they know they couldn't do better than $350, but they went $700 a month, right? And the interest rate is 19, 20, 21% because their credit was jacked up, but they wanted to bling, right? Am I speaking to somebody? This was right before the bubble, which they didn't know was coming, because they're not God. Now, if they had a right walk with the God who sees all things, they could have trusted him to understand the curve, right? Am I making some sense? And see, this is how you have to teach your children, because they're going to come behind us into a mess that's worse than ours over the next 10 years. So the wife's job is tenuous. The husband loses his job, because this is a time of the diminishing of the males in our text. And it corresponds with the time of the diminishing of our males right now. Right now. There is an absolute parallel here, where our males are not prospering. So help me, ladies. No shield, no spear, according to the prophet, judge, teacher, and as we're going to see here in a moment, mother. We're going to see that. That's what I'm going to hone in on for a moment. What do men do when there is a sustained takeaway principle in their life where they don't get to continue to play with their toys and operate out of the presumptions that are afforded them because of prosperity? What do men do? Who knows? Marlis, do you know something about this girl? You've been single all your life. Okay. I'll give you a shout at it before I get some of my sisters who've been in that pit.
Well, they do. Some men just go passive.
I want to write this down, because I'm gonna be talking to my brothers on Saturday about this. Okay, what do you mean by passive?
Well,
Is that what you mean by passive?
He kind
of
gave up.
Okay, he gave up. What would be a term that would apply to him giving up that would be better than passive? Depressed. Do men get depressed when they don't work? They get awfully depressed, don't they? Okay, stay with me now, because actually we're getting ready to unpack posthumously the context in which Deborah is being raised up. Okay? Because God has fashioned all the hearts of men alike. All the hearts of human beings. So from generation to generation, you're dealing with the same dynamics, with the same pathology. So you said we go passive, which is the opposite of assertive, the opposite of aggressive, which requires on a mental disposition, confidence, courage, which is rooted in a theological disposition called faith. Do you believe that? Do you believe that it really requires faith in the midst of opposition to be confident over against odds? Confideo is the Latin term for confidence, and it means to be on God's side. The prefix con is always with. Deo is our root word for defense. Confidence means to be on God's side. So when a man or a woman has confidence, it means that they are on the Lord's side. And when they're not on the Lord's side, they don't have confidence, and they cannot then be assertive or optimistic or aggressive. And as the proverb says, in the day of prosperity, rejoice, but in the day of adversity, wisely consider. Because things are now limited. The periphery is narrow. There are strictures there hindering his capacity to have options. Is that true? He's struggling enormously, and Sister Marlis spoke to passivity, or what we would call a depressed state, that would cause him now to fundamentally start giving up. Is that true? Okay, so then what does that move us into in terms of negative behavior patterns as a consequence? Let me see. My sister right here.
They
can get angry. Oh, is that right? Is that right? Angry. She's right. Isn't she right, ladies? Anger. We want to deal with that. Because, see, when we get into marriage class, again, for some of you who are in marriage class, we do rules of engagement, too. We're going to deal with some of these dynamics again, because we're getting ready to enter into another cycle of it for young couples and new couples who are going to have to deal with these difficult times. And they all come to us. So from a sense of helpless passivity that leads to depression, it moves to an anger. My sister back there, what do they do? Is that what men do? I didn't ask you what they ought to do. Hold on. You didn't hear me. You're talking odds. We're not getting into odds. We're actually getting into the dynamics of what they do to demonstrate why we are looking at a vacuum in our text and why we are looking at a vacuum in our culture. I have my pastor friend Tommy Smith on. He's a pastor of Palmas Hill Baptist Church. We've been developing a good relationship over the last couple of years because we have some common interest. Some differences, but some common interest, and one of them is our concern about the African-American community, more particularly the generations under us, our Gen X's and our Gen Y's, my children and his children. And we were at the same event, and my daughter had received a reward for her academic achievements. And I'm like used to that now, okay? I'm used to our women achieving. It's like, you know, I almost like decided not to go. I wanted to do something else. Sleep in. Go to the gym. Play my guitar. Do something like religious, like study or something, you know. Because she's only an eighth grader, right? Here's my presumption about her. I'll get you in a second, Mother Banks. My presumption about my daughters is that I'll be watching her getting awards for the next 7 years. Is that true? for academic achievement, for personal achievement, for gifts applied in conjunction with academic achievements. I've had six daughters, most of you guys know, and they all have excelled because we are in that context right now. So are you guys hearing what I'm saying? So for me, I would have been far more excited if my son had called and talked about an award that he had achieved. Don't get me wrong, you know, my second to the last son, he's in school for engineering right now. But our daughters are actually achieving. Now, there is a dynamic here that I don't want you to miss. Otherwise, you will be naive. So I'm raising up the issue because I want to talk about the challenges that are facing the male species, particularly in this context and the parallels with where we are, because our answer to the diminishing of a male character and development and strength and presence and influence, our response to it will be right or wrong. And I want to make sure my sisters have a biblical response, because I will assert and admit to you that the response has not always been appropriate. And Mother Deborah will be an example to us if we extrapolate properly all of her giftedness. Okay, Mother Banks. Okay, so now, it's interesting. So, okay. Y'all heard that last line, didn't you? Okay, I'll tell you. I sure will. Because I didn't already tell my daughters. I will pay to get you through school. I will lose an arm so you can get your degree and make your money. But don't bring a cat or dog home. Y'all understand that? Who need me to interpret that tongue? Who need me to interpret that tongue? Yeah. Okay. I'm going to help you and then yes, ma'am.
I'm from the South.
Yes.
You know our situation in the
South. Yes, ma'am.
And I know it's a trouble.
Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Man, that's terrible. Okay, hold on. Wait, hold on. She ain't going to scream. Yeah, I am going to repeat it. But Mother Banks, she's too old to be hollering. You young ladies do the hollering, but Mother Banks is, Mother Banks is like Mother Deborah. You're going to have to come way out to the desert. You got to take that ride and get in line and come all the way up, because she's going to whisper wisdom to you. Now, so what Mother Banks was saying, being from the South, in difficult times, men did two things. They would hide behind their women. That was her experience, and I believe that's true, and I believe it's relevant here. I think we got some steps, though, to get there. It's called abrogating authority. And I know that's the job of the enemy, to get men to abrogate their authority. But it's another very maternal instinct that's going on there that we can talk about here in a moment. And it's important for you as mothers dealing with your sons, particularly in this present generation, you need to know about it. But in their abrogating authority, she said that when there is trouble that occurs, when the man loses his lion-like status, C.S. Lewis talked about an age in which men would be breastless. That means they would not possess what are genuinely virtuous characteristics with men to stand up to the trouble in protecting of their homes and dealing with the issues. Breastless. That means they would be heartless. They would be small-breasted, or he called them no-breasted. And she's saying that they would get their wives to actually deal with the problems that are going on. Is that true? Absolutely. Absolutely. And at that point, you know, we're dealing with a deep infiltration of the adversary in the conscience and in the mind of the man. He's now completely emasculated. He does not have any confidence to deal with structures, authorities, powers, right? And this is important for you to know, because if you react wrongly to it, you're going to actually sink him deeper into his pit. You know that, right? Because you're going to get mad because he ain't mad enough. Right? See, the devil going to get all up into that. So it's important to understand this, because when we actually deal with Deborah is going to be actually demonstrating levels of wisdom that demonstrate her maturity as a woman and her care for her men. This is a critical method of wisdom in which she is implementing her God-given role as a teacher, as a leader, as a prophet, as a nurturer, and as a mother. But we're not there yet, but I'm just saying, so I wanted to work it through. I saw another hand up here, my young sister right there. So what you know about men? Girl, you're only 16 years old. I'm kidding.
I was going to say that
they compromise. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because it's your observation, right? You are seeing this. They compromise what? In what way? Come on now. We got to be a little bit more explicit for the record. Compromise their relationships, meaning. Do you affirm that? Okay. See, now you're finalizing it. I want to get there because that is true. That is true. And when you say compromise from a young person's perspective, you are seeing that they actually were operating in certain noble principles, particularly religious boys, right? Good church going fellas, right? The ones that love the Lord, read their Bibles, preach and teach to their girlfriend till they lose their job. Can I tell the truth? That's right. Because it's in the test that character is revealed. It's in the test that character is revealed and character is forged. So it's important for us to know this. I saw another hand here, Miss Sammy. Okay, now I'm glad somebody told the truth. So now we're going to use drugs, you know, alcohol, medical marijuana. I am having a ball with my brothers trying to justify the herb of the field. I am just amazed at, but what is that? Hold on now, because I want to talk about that. You know that that is a component here, but it's a component because it's actually addressing something else. So when we lose our job, we lose our sense of confidence because we have inordinately and in a wrong way associated our self-worth with our vocation, which is wrong as a Christian. Is that true?
Yes.
So we didn't go deep enough into Christ where we could extricate ourselves from our performance so that we are who we are, not because of what we do, but because whose we are. And whose we are doesn't change when my circumstance changes. But you got to go deep enough into Christ to be able to stay in your position when everything else changes. And it's that man that you're going to see emerge up out of the trouble if you just watch him and leave him alone and only affirm him in those necessary areas until he grows up. Otherwise, you're going to find the man who was conveniently Christian until he lost his job, right? And then depression sets in. He gives up on his, what we had learned several months ago when we opened up, his schema. Remember that? Remember the difference between a scheme and a substance? The schema is what we appear to be, and the substance is what we really truly are. In the Greek language, hypostasis is the term for substance. It has to do with the hypostatic nature of Jesus Christ. It has to do with our ontology. Substance is the reality underneath that which appears. And so we can actually operate out of a scheme, an appearance of something. And then when there's enough heat, that appearance dissipates and we appear to be what we really are, either, a hypocrite or weak or not what we said we were, or really, truly a man. And we're just going through that process of character development, right? These are the battles that we're dealing with. These are the battles that they were dealing with. This is why God raised Mother Deborah up. He raised her up because these are issues that have to be dealt with from a uniquely given perspective that's critical to your education and to mine. I saw one more hand before we go on. Sister Maddie. Huh? They move into blame. Who they blaming? You? Okay, so that stays under the category of what? Anger. Right? Right? Anger. I agree with that. Do you guys agree with that? Isn't it an interesting dynamic? Because y'all do it too. Isn't it an interesting dynamic how we blame each other? How we go to blaming. And that's a weakness of character, right? And it's something that both spouses have to understand. What are we doing when we resort to the medication? What are we doing? Trying to kill what?
Pain.
The pain of what?
Loss,
the pain of loss of dreams, hopes, and failures. Okay. Anything else? Trying to kill the pain of the situation? Okay, I agree with that. I guess the situation gets bad enough to want to kill it, right? Kill the feeling. Right? Any other observation before I move on? But he doesn't know. So I don't want you to be repetitive, because I think you're on a good point. I think you're on a good point about where we're getting ready to go to now. The kind of perspective that a godly woman has to have in the context of a culture like ours. And what I was saying earlier was that it doesn't do any good to react in a wrong way towards the demise of the male species in this context. It's critical that our sisters have a grasp of the plot that you're talking about. Right? There's an assumption that you have enough clarity on this unseen dimension, which is constantly at war against all of us. Remember, we opened up the text and we're in a what? Now, and so Miss Pat is, she is affirming what should be. That's another ought. This is why I was actually staying with right now the reality. Cause we can get into oughts. Oughts are hypotheticals that are essential after we affirm the reality. Because the reality is most women don't actually acknowledge the plot either. So we get to talking what we should be doing. But in a lot of times what happens is, and now you ladies can actually speak to that with me, because here's Deborah rising up, and there are not a whole lot of women rising up in this context either. So when our men diminish, does it affect our women? So we can tell some truth, right? We don't have super Amazonian women, do we? You know the super Amazonian women? Y'all don't know them. They can swing through trees. They have bow and arrows and swords. They ride horses, you know, breast free. They can kill men and women all by themselves. And so what I'm getting at is that what I want you to do is sympathize with and draw out the contextual setting, which is more real to where we are today than you might want to admit. It's more real to where we are today than you might want to admit, and it's not going anywhere. So some of you mamas, because Sister Deborah was a mother in a larger national sense. We do not know if she was an actual mother. There's nothing in the text that says that. But the text says she was a mother. So she had all of the virtues of a mother, whatever those are, essential to answer the situation, right? So, if we adopt that characteristic, she said, I, Deborah, rose up a mother in Israel. She didn't say a judge. She didn't say a preacher. She didn't say a prophetess. She said a mother. Amazing. Because it gives insight into her awareness of her calling for the season. That she understood that God doesn't violate his rules. That God is into restoring things because of a covenant agenda. And so here she is raised up a mother, which tells me that the answer to the present cultural problem is motherly characteristics and attributes that are consistent with the character of God. So stay with me for a minute. I actually believe that. I actually believe that the struggles that are going on in our present generation, I am not blaming them on mothers. I'm laying part of the answer upon mothers. Am I making some sense? That the motherly attribute, the motherly characteristic, instinct, the wisdom, the nurturing, the virtue, the gifting of a mother in the truest and the most virtuous sense, is critical in a culture when our men are demasculated, when they have been devastated and they have been stripped of their powers, and they've resorted to getting high and being on drugs and functioning in a criminal lifestyle that ends up putting them in institutions. And in institutions, the last thing that's in the institution is a motherly representation of essential virtues to help nurture them. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? Like, if a wounded man who is broken from the circumstances, which are a consequence of his idolatries, gets thrown in prison, he becomes even more susceptible to victimization. Are you guys hearing me?
Yeah.
Good. Good. So then we can move on. Miss Virginia.
Okay, you got it. Huh? A deeper hole financially.
Right, which is stealing. You know, for those who have the capacity to get credit cards, which is a bad thing. Because a broke person shouldn't have a credit card. Can I just keep that real? No broke people ought to have credit cards. Right? Because that's stealing. So, you know, that's a lack of character too when we're putting it on credit. What's that? And claiming bankruptcy. Right. That's a problem too. Okay, so we're going to turn the corner here in a second and deal with Mother Deborah a little bit, okay, because I want to do that. And then I'm going to have the outline for you for next week, because I don't have it this week. I'm going to have the outline for you for next week. And how many of you read chapter 5? Did you read chapter 5? Okay, I'm going to have you to read it again, because I'm going to have the outline for you, and then we're going to unpack the outline that I have here, because I want us to go into that. I hope I have persuaded you that the conditions of Israel at that time are relative to where we are, and that the essential problem of that context is it's the same context in which we're living, where our men are not what they should be, and that in many cases they have disappeared, and that puts a very serious onus on our sisters, of which I don't know if we have done the best job that we could to actually help deliver them. We can talk about that now. Have we actually implemented a biblical motherhood approach to our brothers or our sons or our daughters? Marlis, are you a mother?
Well, not genetically.
Okay.
Can I add one more piece of reality?
Okay, then we'll go forward.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
What do y'all think about that? I don't know nothing about, I don't know if I make that ultimate extreme correlation. Help me. I may be wrong.
Okay, a man loses his wife or his girlfriend, and so he goes and kills her. Another man, I know.
How about the word violence?
Violence.
Okay. All right, can I use that?
Because
if I use the word violence, I'm not going to turn my brothers into murderers that quick. Because see, I'm actually trying to save them. So that's why I got a little problem with Marlis. Okay. Okay. Hold on. That's your sister. Now let's work with that for a moment. And then I'm going to back up. We're going to back up and talk about characteristics and attributes of motherhood in the context of leadership, because I think it's critical. I can accept that answer from Marlis. I really can. Not because of any kind of unique idiosyncrasy in her, but she's not married and she's not a mother. There's a privilege from that position to deal with things more objectively. So objectivity is a privilege as well as subjectivity. So I'm going to pull most of you back to a subjective mode of analyzing our text. So how many of you in here are mothers? Okay, good, 90%. My sister, Miss Trimu back there, she's about to have us a little baby girl, right? Yeah, God bless you, my sister. Miss Trimu's back there in the beautiful kind of bright, hot red, back there smiling. And so when are we due? July? July 25th. Bless you, my sister. Bless you. What's her name?
Olivia.
Olivia, that's right. She listening to me preach already. Bless your heart, girl. I love my daughters. And it's really weird. I mean, it's weird because God has exercised my senses personally in the area of womanhood for the last 35 years with six daughters. And so I'm constantly balancing femininity and the uniqueness of female gifting in the context of what should be strong male presence and application. Seeing how that goes. That's why I'm sensitive. That's why I'm working it the way I'm working it before we actually deal with the odds. The odds. Because you have to deal with odds. Odds are where God wants us to be. So it gives us a cause for endeavoring. Right? Do they resort to violence? Don't they resort to abuse? They have an inclination to abuse their wives and their children. It's true. Is that right? That becomes another evidence of abrogating their authority, another evidence that they have fallen prey to being giving up and being rooted in an anger that causes them to miss the strategy that the enemy actually set up. They should be fighting the enemy, and the target gets turned to the spouse and the children. That's true, isn't it? That's very true. And then after they do that, out of guilt, they go get high. Is that true? Yeah. That's the cycle that we're dealing with. And then we have to lock them up. And in prison, it goes from bad to worse. So there has to be a remedy for that. And for God, it was Deborah. So we're going to touch on that a little bit. My sister back there, you've got a point to make. So we operate out of three fundamental psychological predispositions, all of us. We are either because our situation is healthy and divinely favored, rested. That's the kind of man you want. Because we're healthy and divinely favored, we are in a rest mode. In a rest mode, you are more balanced. More objective, you can deal with things in a much more critically sound light. That's why for those of you who are couples, I will say this. Endeavor to make your home a home of peace. Okay? Don't make it a war zone. Don't make it a war zone. This here is a gift to you mothers and wives who sometimes have to be mothers to your husband. You know how you get frustrated about being mothers to your husbands? Don't you get frustrated with that? Don't you get tired? My sister say, yes, yes, yes. Okay. I have to proceed. You got to stop for a second. Because your sister's going to get tired of you answering questions. And they love you to death. So we want to keep. I want to turn the corner for a second. We only got 20 minutes to go. 25 minutes. And we can maybe talk about it a little bit because I just actually want to get into this thought because I know where I'm going in my outline. And the next point that we're going to be dealing with next week, I'm going to be raising the question, what are the typical roles that Deborah plays or executes in our context? Obviously, she's a judge. Obviously, she's a prophet. Obviously, she's a educator. But my first answer was that she was a mother. Okay? That was my first answer. And I'm actually dealing with it on a larger scope than just being a biological mother. Right. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I'm keeping you tied to the fundamentals of this class, which is called what kind of theology? Biblical theology. And in biblical theology, we start with a covenant God. Right? And that covenant God laid down mandates for humanity, which began first with the man and the woman operating in the image and character of God. And then for them to be successful in their relationship, it had to be within the framework of marital covenant, right? So covenant was articulated by God in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Then covenant was, it was framed by God in Genesis 2, 22 through 24 in the context of marriage. He said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, right? Let us make them male and female in the image of God. He made them. So men and women are ontologically equal, right? We are both the image bearers of God, right? But we do so from a complementarian standpoint, from a different standpoint. We share attributes alike, and then there are characteristics and attributes that we do not share. Are you guys following what I'm saying? Otherwise, he would be operating out of what I've said so many times, a redundancy principle. He did not make an Adam and an Adam, or an Eve and an Eve. He made a male and female. Male and female. Those are two distinct species, though they bear equal ontology in their DNA, their chromosomal makeup. There are unique characteristics that are woman's only and man's only. We have crossovers, right? And so, in God's ideal, these two are to achieve their goals of existence and purpose by operating in a God consciousness, a vertical awareness of who God is and who they are in God, and then in their own relationship, if they're going to enter into the enterprise of proliferation, right? Because like, we have some here. Who here has never been married before? Okay, good. So we got 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10, 10, 10, 12 folks here that have not been married before. Who here ain't ever getting married?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, all right. So because it will be true that if they don't get married, if they don't enter into the marital paradigm, then they won't be challenged with the dynamics that go on between male and females on that level, right? You won't be challenged with the dynamics. Because to enter into covenant with a man is a real challenge. That's an understatement, huh? But it's so. So I'm simply saying that because when God raises up Deborah, Deborah's married. She needs that experience actually to be able to adjudicate her calling to the whole of the nation, because the nation is not females in prison or males in prison. It is a society of men and women in the context of family, which is the normative structure in our world. It's changing quickly, but as a whole, our world is made up of what Genesis chapter 1 and 2 had designated, right? Married couples with children and families. So a person who would be in a rulership position, knowing that the constituency, the larger constituency, would be that of married couples with women and children, we would really want that individual to have some knowledge, some working knowledge of male and female relationship dynamics. Is that true? Can you imagine all of those folks coming up to Deborah's palm tree, Deborah's palm tree, and not at some point talking about domestic conflicts in the home? Could you imagine that? Now, let me say that again just in case you didn't get it. Can you imagine the sisters always just coming up talking politics and religion? Right. So you know she's answering a lot of questions about the breakdown of the family, the destruction of the family, the conflict between husbands and wives, the battle between parents and children, which is the same battle we're dealing with. That's why I'm saying it's so relevant. We never even countenance the thought that Scripture is not contemporaneous and relevant to where we are. It is. So my premise is that God raised up a mother in Israel to deal with that. And so I begin to ask you now, as we start winding down the thought, what does that mean to you? That at the highest of the titles that Deborah is going to bear, judge and legislator and nurturer, educator and prophet, because she's definitely prophesying. This battle was won by a vision she had given to her by God, of which she articulates to a man of whom we have to deal with next week. And everything happened explicitly according to her prophetic unction, which means she has a good relationship with God. And yet she says, I, Deborah, rose up a mother in Israel. I love it. Because she was not denying her femininity. She was not denying her role. She was actually augmenting her role to be able to demonstrate that the unique virtues of not just a woman, but a mother play a significant, significant part in the restoration of a broken culture. Does that proposition make sense to you guys? Okay, so let's work it for a little bit. What do I mean by that? What do we mean by that? How can we speak to that? The mother connotation of Miss Deborah. That's smart. That's a good way to leave it. And I don't have anything to say about it other than it didn't speak to the characteristic of mother. It does speak to the characteristic of a complementary relationship between men and women. It does speak to what I had stated 2 weeks ago, that when you read your Bible, do not fall prey to a feminist interpretation of Scripture or a secular patriarchal model, because the battle of the sexes is not biblical. It's secular. Right. And the answer is not, you know, let the women take over. We'll fix everything. That's not the answer to the problem. You guys, it can be a component to it, but that's not the answer. You guys know. So when Sister Ethel is stating that God can use both, he intended to use both. And what I had stated in our understanding of the covenant was that it was part of the decree to use both, that we didn't get to Judges chapter 4 from Genesis 1 without Eve, without Noah's wife, without Abraham's wife, without Isaac's wife, without Jacob's wife. They all contributed significantly to advance the cause of Christ up to Deborah. Y'all believe that?
Yeah.
Right. With all of the issues, we can pick out each couple and learn lots of lessons from both of them in terms of their virtues and their vices, their weaknesses and their strengths. But that's what God meant to use. He meant to use that. My sister Pam. Sister Pam is talking about Sister Esther. I love me some Esther. That's a good book. And she definitely plays a much more mediatorial role. By implication, maybe, and perhaps she exercised some motherly elements there, but we would be real hard pressed. In this context, there's such a one-to-one relationship between Deborah and the children of Israel. Esther sits in the palace of Ahasuerus. He's the king of Persia, and there's a separation between the people of God and the Persian Gentiles. Although, like Pam is saying, on a larger, more celestial, spiritual way, here is the mother again of Israel, though married to a Gentile, serving to mediate. Right? And so there's something there in the paps that she is able to utilize to protect the children from destruction, because they're about to be destroyed in the book of Esther. So are y'all following me? Because actually what I'm raising up here for your contemplation are the multiple and varied elements of what it means to be a mother. And that if those motherly attributes are disregarded and not respected and not employed simply because you're angry, right? Simply because you're angry, then all of us lose out. You know who loses out? Not only the boys, not only the men, but the daughters too. Is that true? So, you know, I kind of know where I'm going. I'm kind of milking this. Because I have an outline in front of me. I didn't get a chance to print it out, but I want to hear from you now, just instinctually, how beneficial or detrimental Deborah's role as a mother judge would be. You will be last, Sister Deborah.
Well, I just think in terms of her family.
Got it. I appreciate that. I appreciate the way Deborah defined Deborah. Did y'all get that?
Yeah.
Although I'm gonna argue with her about the way she just depicted my brother Barrett. Hold on. I know how you sisters are. I got y'all sisters. Because the assumption is that he was actually retreating out of a weakness. But next week we will demonstrate that there was something much more rich. Do you understand that this book is about Christ? And Barak is a central Christ figure in this text. Do you understand that? that there are two prophecies in the Psalms and in the New Testament that center Barak in the actual atonement that actually delivers God's people. He is a crystal clear picture of Christ. Now, with that, I'm going to leave it with you because you'll get a chance to see it in a few weeks, even next week. If that is true, this is what we mean by a Christocentric hermeneutic. If Barak really is a Christ type, then the manner in which he engaged Mother Deborah was actually an act of wisdom. Okay? And while we may countenance a concept of weakness, that weakness will simply correspond to the very thing needed in order to get the job done. Okay, so we'll work on that in a few weeks. We'll work on that next week, maybe, Lord willing. A concept of the mother. We got 10 minutes to go. Let's see, sister. No, my sister right here. Yeah, you. You the one that drive the Corvette. Okay. John a vet. Okay, so mark that for yourself. Would it be a virtue for the woman who is in a place of authority to be prominently exercising encouragement and edification and lifting up? So, I want you to mark that. And then let's confess that that's an area of weakness in our life. Right? Are we there? All right. See, that's what. So we can go to work. We can beat up on Barak, but let's go to work. Because when she says, "I'm a mother in Israel," what she is recognizing is what is needed for the moment to restore the men. Listen. See, I don't want to jump too quick, but this sister was able to get one brother to actually get 10,000 brothers to go to war. So that was something about her that was remarkable. So, you understand? 10,000. 10,000. This is no joke. We getting ready to go to war and 10,000 brothers rise up. And by the way, again, just defending my brother Barak. Barak had to have a level of sway and influence on the brothers to call them to that task when nothing else was calling them to that task for all those years that they were under oppression. Are y'all hearing what I'm saying? So we'll tie all of the redemptive strands together because you don't want to miss that. There are redemptive strands because this is about Jesus. Now remember, he works through his church. That's why you can't leave Deborah out. Deborah, and you can't leave this other sister out who is just a hot sister, man. I will have her go to war with me anytime she wants to. Jail. She rises up on the scene out of nowhere. Cold, isn't she? Is Jail cold? Isn't she the little twist in the movie? Man. She rises up in like, you know, 3/4 of the movie. Who is this sister? And the main enemy, the nemesis enemy, falls prey to this sister. Did she work him? Did she work him? Was she smooth? See, I can start with her character, her decorum, her ostensive respect. But this sister loved her some God. Are you guys hearing me? So God has this heroine in his quiver, because the context of this whole event of judging has to do with the complementarian relationship between the man and the woman, and how God has always intended women to play a central role in the advancement of the gospel. And in this context, as Sister Deborah had stated it, the honor will go to a woman. And she wasn't talking about herself. She was talking about Jael. Yeah. We ain't done. See, she already saw the end from the beginning. And y'all acting like Barak had a problem with that. He didn't have no problem with that. If you read the text carefully, he slew all of the enemy. And he was hunting Sisera down. He was going to kill him too. Right. You guys saw that, right? So I don't see any kind of weakness in him. He's actually fulfilling a role that demands that we understand the relationship between Christ and the church and the manner in which the job gets done. My sister. That's close. Now, we're jumping into that portion of Scripture, but just to be safe, to be honest with the context, follow this. The prophecy comes through the woman. The prophecy is from God. The prophecy is not about Deborah. It doesn't even speak to Deborah's essential necessity in the prophecy. The prophecy is strictly, go kill him. Right? So technically speaking, Barak didn't need another word, didn't need no help. He had a word already, and he could have rolled on that word. Right? Are you guys following? I'm going to help you just so you can enjoy this when you go home. But he knew Deborah's influence on the culture. And he was not going to neglect that influence in marshaling the men together. See, some of those men came up from way down Southern California, because they way up in the north, in the ghetto. This is up way up in the ghetto where they are. And some of those men came up with their wives to talk to Deborah. There was one arguing. You know the couples that argue right before they come into the church? Right? These are husbands and wives arguing and fighting, and then they come to church pretending they're all right. Then they come up to Deborah, and she helped rightly divide the situation and bless that family, and they go back home, and he's happy that he came. Barak was able to call 10,000 of these cats, and they came. So we'll work that through. We'll work all that through. I've got five more minutes. The motherly concept, the motherly component in reparations and reconciliation and strengthening and invigorating our men. You know how hard that is for a woman to do? Do you guys know how hard that is? Do you see your weakness as a female and the inability to actually get on the right side of a man and help bring him up? Even your teenagers and young people. That's not easy to do. So I just need, you know, all I need is an honest sister in the house. You know, motherhood is a real, real, real task. It's a gift when it's there. When you have that gift of encouraging and lifting up, that's a gift. You know that because you know so many years wherein you were depleted in that capacity. That's true. Maddie. That's it. Yes, ma'am. Does that work? Huh. So stay with her now. Is what Maddie just said fully redemptive in its framework? Isn't that Genesis 3:15? Isn't that the seed of the woman? Isn't she a major component in his coming forth and the destruction of the adversary? Y'all going to see all that because Jeho rises up behind Deborah, the word of the Lord, and the power of God. Those are the two meanings, the word of the Lord and the power of God, to actually execute this job. Y'all going to see all that. It's there. It's there for our edification. And what I am saying by way of application is we don't want to be distracted by our present culture of superficiality and carnality that drives our women to a kind of narcissistic sort of self-absorption when there is a major, major need to apply yourself in your gifting for the good of our sisters and our brothers, and particularly our young men and our children. We want to grow in that motherly task. And it does not confine you to just your own children. When my sisters are able to actually operate out of those kind of motherly giftings where, like Maddie was saying, having a vision for the seed, right? Having a vision. So you guys can see how Deborah could have been sitting under the tree drinking her lemonade, and every child, every young adult, every middle-aged adult where they had the capacity to continue to be fruitful and multiply, that she had a major, major role in contributing to the advancement of the kingdom by telling them to live right and praying for them and encouraging them and hugging the babies that came. Right? Can you guys see that? I mean, that's critical. That's huge. Deborah represents the church. That's what a church is supposed to be. That's what every local assembly is supposed to be as an aggregate whole. Do you understand that? That when sinners come in here broken up, toe up, messed up, jacked up, frazzed up, that there should be that balance between the male-female dynamic where they have protection and security, but also nurturing and guidance, right? Shouldn't that be the local church? Right. Sister Marla said, we'll close. Who is Gloria Steiner? Okay, got it. I'm there now. Didn't y'all like that? Didn't that mean freedom for y'all? Wasn't y'all tired of those girdles? Couldn't breathe. Okay. I got 6 daughters and a wife. So, you know, I've been fighting over this bra stuff for like 35 years. Go on. Man, did she get down or what? Man, that's the part that men like. That's why I love my wife. I tell her, girl, we met fighting. Me and my wife met fighting. We met fighting. So she can protect me when I get old. That's why I tell her, build that core up, girl. Because if I break my leg, I'm climbing on your back. Carry a brother. Oh, y'all terrible. Oh, y'all terrible. Hold on now. I mean, aren't we supposed to be a team? If I'm in the trenches and I get hurt, shouldn't my wife be able to carry me out the trenches? Oh, y'all cold. Okay. Y'all cold. Yeah. Don't you think so, Deb? I heard y'all supposed to be strong sisters. Strong sisters. Put me on the back and walk me through the Sahara and lay me down under a tree and nurture me back to health. Send me back to the battle, huh? I agree with that proposition. Did you hear what she just said? If the teaching is overly submissive, it by de facto abrogates your responsibility to play an assertive role in building and strengthening and maturing and developing. Is that true? I agree with that. Right, and I'll just say this in relationship to what, cause when Marlis gets an epiphany, she gets it. No, really. I mean, she does. Because this is not about being married. I drug that out because that plays a major role in the structure of our society. But it still remains that you guys are females and I always structure the class around the female element. I don't talk to our men like this. I talk to them on the other side. Because there are male responsibilities, characteristics, and attributes that they need to focus in on, and we do so that way. For you to have a class that would be asexual or afeminine or amotherly would miss the point. If it's too purely abstract in the theological sense, you will have no way to appropriately apply it to who you are on the ontological, on the personal, on the spiritual, on the psychological, on the emotional, on the giftedness of being a female. How are you going to actually execute your calling as a female without deriving all of these as points of application to your life? Because you know what you have to do when you leave here in a few minutes? You have to go home to either your husband or your children or wherever you go and all that you deal with, and whether you are single or not, and we're past that time and several of us are, but you raise children. How many of you are still dealing with grandchildren? Yeah, great grandchildren. Do you think your job is done? Do you get to just be an old Christian hag? You know what I'm saying? Just an old Christian hag, so bad that the grandchildren don't even drive on the same block that you live. Oh, grandmama lived out. Go way around. Because all you do is go to church. Right? Because all you do is go to church. And your great-grandchildren don't think of you fondly. Which they should. Because I can tell you, I grew up, I was a product of a fatherless home. So I'm a typical fellow from the hood here in the Bay Area, your pastor. So I didn't have the balance of a loving, protective father initiating what was essential to character development as a man. So I defaulted into a lot of dumb stuff where that vacuum was, where young men are. I had a great mom, But my mother could only actually facilitate so much. You guys have done massive jobs at being a facilitator, but you know you can't fully occupy that male component. And when you try to, you distort both ends, both male and female when you do that. And you're going to jack your boys up and your girls. That's true. It's really true. And I'm not saying that, you know, you throw your hands up and say, if I don't have a man in the house. Listen, you ladies, that's why I use the sort of exaggerated analogy that I want my wife to actually continue getting strong so she can carry me. That was a metaphor. But I do mean it physically, too. I just want you to know. But for the most part, it was no, you don't know. Like, even now, I'll be on the floor and I say, Barb, give me a hand up. I never used to talk like that. I was giving her it. Barb, give her brother a hand up. She the one going and working out, building her core up, lifting the 15 pounds. Here, you get pick a brother up. So now if I fall down and break my leg, wouldn't I want my wife to reach down and... Wouldn't you want to be healthy to be able to do that for your man? Yeah. You know, that way I can feel a little security. Shouldn't I have some security around my wife? Plus, she knows karate too. Woo! I go to sleep at night comfortable. You know what? If the thief breaks in, we, just in case y'all don't know, I taught martial arts for years. That's where we met. In martial arts, my sisters do know. So I actually, you know, I taught her for many, many years. She's good. But I'm just saying, if we have to whoop up on somebody, I can say, Barb, go to the left. Right flank. And then we can go to work. Kind of like our text. Is that all right? I mean, y'all might not like me after the night, but that's okay. That's why I give my wife every dime I got. Just as long as she keep working out. Help a brother out. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for my sisters. Thank you for allowing us to work through what we know are the challenges in our present generation, as it was for Mother Deborah, Sister JL, Brother Barack, and all of those who finally did rise up to the call. May we be gifted in this generation to rise up to the call and serve to help recover this generation in which we are living. And I ask that you give all my sisters the prophetic unction, the unction to rightly divide the word of God, the unction to stand in their role as women, their role as sisters, their role as mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers, the capacity to be nurturing, the capacity to be gentle and thoughtful, the capacity to draw people of God to them and those who are in need so that they can find in them your glory. As it is to be expressed fully in your church and by both men and women. Forgive us of our sin. Help us where we are short in all of these areas. As we go our way, give us traveling mercies, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless you, ladies.